April 25th, 2013. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Pope Runyon. And tonight we present a discussion on the practice of the Vajra Yogini Tantra as undertaken by OTA members and Gardnerians at the Sakya Center in Los Angeles in October through November 1985, under the direction of Abbot Luding Ken Rinpoche of the Sakya Order Nagor sect of Tibetan Buddhism. Now, this was a rare opportunity for Westerners to take initiations and an extended training course in Tibetan tantric practice, supervised by Tibetan lamas and delivered in English by an American lama, Nagawang Samten. Now, my mentor in anthropology, Dr. Robert Ravitz, had been over to Dharamsala, India several times, and he recommended the program to me, and frankly, he told me, he said, Pope, he said, you will be getting something that many people have gone to Asia, given up everything, spent years, and still not received, so get the most out of it. Well, I certainly tried to, and I found it to be one of the most meaningful experiences in my magical career. Our sessions with Luding Ken Rinpoche and Lama Samten lasted a month. Now, we started with a Hevajra initiation. That's the highest tantra of the Sakya order, and that's their what you might call their patron yadam, as the most important yadam practice of the order, and this was our certification and the planting of the seed. Now, this was followed by a Chenrezig initiation, a Padmasambhava initiation, White Tara, and then an intensive Vajrayogini initiation and practice. This was from a 100-page syllabus detailing all of the rites and practices. Now, this Vajrayogini program is a complete tantric system, which includes tummo, that's the yoga of heat, and powa, which is death practice. And Vajrayogini is very popular with Tibetans and Westerners alike. She's a very close analog to the Canaanite goddess Anath. And programs like the one we participated in are now being offered more frequently here in America. And you might check with H.H. Sakya Trezin's website for details. So if you want to find out what it's like to meditate with the Eastern Masters, I will try to share our recollections with you. Now, first I want to say that that back when I first got started in ceremonial magic, about 1969, I became very interested in Tibetan Buddhism along with Western ceremonial magic. And I was trying to take a Jungian approach to both of them. And so I read all of the Evans Wentz material and the Alexandra David Neal books. And so I had a fairly good idea of, I thought I did anyway, of what Tibetan Tantric Buddhism was like. And so I had at least a conception of what it was like. But then, we started the OTA in 1970, and we even came up with an idea of somehow or other trying to get the Dalai Lama Xerox machine, I remember, and we wrote to Dharamsala and told him we were going to try to get one, and we were going to, I think we had delusions of grandeur or something like that, because we finally found out that Xerox had a they had an outlet in India, and we'd have to go through that, and of course we had no way of doing anything there, but the Dalai Lama and his brother Jigme Narbu were nice enough. Jigme Narbu was nice enough to write us back and thank us, and we kind of had a feeling, we really felt close to, and in there, even in our remote way, we had a soft place in our heart for him. And so when I got my master's degree in cultural anthropology at Cal State Northridge in 1980, and I kept up, with my connection with the university and occasionally took classes out there. My mentor and on my committee was Dr. Robert Rabbits, and out there in Northridge, and this was really his specialty was Tibetan Tantric Buddhism, and he'd been over to Dharamsala. Let me explain that Dharamsala, India, is up in northern India. It's where the Tibetans came down when the Dalai Lama left Tibet with the Chinese, of course, moving in. And he left Tibet with his entourage and with thousands and thousands of Tibetan refugees who just couldn't live under the Chinese dictatorship or whatever you want to call it. Anyway, they settled in Dharamsala, which is a town in northern India, and the Indian government was nice enough to let them move in there, kind of. And they reestablished themselves, and that became the headquarters of the Dalai Lama. So those of us who were here in this country who really wanted to get deeply into it made the pilgrimage to Dharamsala. And I considered doing that, but frankly, couldn't afford it and one thing or another, wanted to. But Bob Rabbits had gone over there several times, and so he recommended me for this program. He knew about the Sakya Center here in Los Angeles, and he knew that Lu Ning Chen and his ritual group, that they were going to bring this program over, and in fact they were going to do this naturally to see how many converts they could make and strengthen the Sakya presence here in this country. That was the idea, and introduce those of us who were interested into the process. Now, Robert Rabbits recommended me, and I, of course, was anxious to sign up for it. And apparently, a couple of ladies in the Gardnerian witchcraft group, they found out about it and they signed up. And then I had Sarah Shashat from our group and got her into it. And we had another academic who was into Franz Barden, and that was old Theo, and I don't keep his last name. He signed up. So there was a number of us who knew each other who got into this. And the main thing that we were interested in was this Vajrayogini program. I didn't know too much about Vajrayogini except what I read in Evans Wentz, and of course Evans Wentz may be dated by this time, but she had a reputation of, according to Wentz and others, of being a very magical type of goddess, and she was very, very beautiful. In her modern Tonkas, a Tonka, by the way, is a picture. It's a picture of the god or the goddess or the god or the gal or gods and goddesses intertwined that you meditate on. And all Tibetan practices have a mandala, which is the symbolic, geometric symbolic depiction of the geometric symbolism involved in the practice. And then they have, along with that, they have a thanka, which is the picture of like a well, like a an illustration of the god or the goddess, or god and goddess, of the practice that you're doing. So you have two major artworks that you work from, and I think most of you understand that the big difference between Western magic, at least the way we practice it, and Tibetan tantric practice, is that we use our imagination to create something that we aren't quite exactly sure what it's going to look like. We bring it up out of our subconscious, and we train our imagination in the abstract, and then we go and we bring these entities up out of our subconscious using a conjuration device like a crystal ball or a mirror, and we bring them up, and they appear not exactly the way we expect them to. Now, the difference, of course, in Tibetan practice is that they create the deity. They actually sit down in an asana, and they, with intense concentration, they will create this deity. And some of the deities, of course, have so many attributes and so many arms and are so complicated that it makes it very, very difficult. Fortunately, Vajra Yogini is a very, very simple visualization. And it's a visualization very easy to do. And she only has two arms, and doesn't have a consort. Well, she has a consort, but she's never pictured with her consort. Her consort, by the way, is Chakra Samvara, but he's pictured with her, but she is never pictured with him, and she's complete in herself. And but you develop the goddess or the god or whatever, the entity completely in your imagination. You practice and practice and practice and practice, and the idea is to bring this visualization to life. That's the catch. And it works. Of course, it does work. I mean, it really does. Now, I'm not saying our method doesn't work. Our method works, too. But still, it's different. And yet we, our magic here in the West, especially OTA, has benefited so much from an infusion of Tibetan practice. I mean, the combination of the two. Really, this strengthens our magic tremendously. And I've tried in my own small way to duplicate, their idea of the mandala and the tantra. And then use that and still use our conjuration devices. The Tibetans, at least as far as I know, they really don't use crystal balls and dark mirrors. I know Lobsang Rampa, the British Cyril Hoskins, I think his name was, that said he was writing books back in the late 60s and early 70s, and he claimed that they were using crystal balls, but they don't. I mean, the Tibetan tantric Buddhism is an exercise in creating this entity in your imagination and then bringing it to life, and bringing it to such powerful life that it will empower you, and it will the entity will empower you, the entity will inspire you. But then, and I have to tell you this, I know some people aren't going to want to hear it, but then the idea is to once you get that entity and bring it to life, then you dissolve it, take it into yourself. Because no matter how much you have brought it to life, the ultimate idea is in Buddhism that it is ultimately an illusion. Now, I know that sounds, it's very difficult for Westerners to really relate to that, but that is their ultimate philosophy. However, look at it this way. They consider everything to be an illusion. Even God at the highest level is an illusion. So, consequently, illusions are really, in a sense, a kind of a measure of reality. Now, this is, in a way, kind of similar to Hermetic philosophy, so similar that the Dalai Lama has come out and declared that Hermetic philosophy is very similar to Tibetan Buddhism, in the sense that in Hermetic philosophy, everything is a measure of reality. Nothing is what it seems. Nothing is, and Hermes himself said that the gods of the zodiac are eternal and man creates the gods of the earth sphere. Quote, Hermes Trismegistus. This is very similar to Tibetan Buddhism. In fact, you can say that the only real difference is we consider everything some measure of reality, even what we can imagine to be some measure of reality. And they believe that everything, including what they imagine, is an illusion. So you can flip it. You can flip it, and it just about comes out the same way. And you can say also, too, if you want to, that theirs is a glass half empty and ours is a glass half full, if you want to look at it that way. But the idea here is to make this practice as real as you possibly can, and there is the magical power, and there is the magic. And Vajrayogini is a very, very empowering, a very empowering goddess. Now, you can go on, if you want to take a look at her, go on Sakyatrizin's website, and that's Sakyatrizin, Trazin, and Google Vajrayogini, and you'll get there. And there's a real nice talk. I'm looking at it. They put a little, just to be kind of nice, they put a little lace loincloth on her that she didn't originally have, but that's probably a concession to modesty for the West. But yeah, she is standing on her. She's all red, by the way. Now that doesn't mean she's necessarily a wrathful Dakini. She's an energetic Dakini. The wrathful deities are more black than red, actually. And in some cases, they're red. But you notice, if you look at the Thaka, you'll see she has a third eye. And she's drinking blood out of a skull cup, and she's got all a necklace of skulls, and she has a flaying knife. And, for butchering human corpses in her right hand, and she has the ritual staff over her shoulder, and so she has a tiara made of skulls, and she got little fangs, but she's very sexy, and she's surrounded by an arch of flames, and standing on a mandala, which is actually looks like a regular hexagram, a regular Mogen David type hexagram, which is typical though, because in the Hindu psychic centers, that's the heart chakra, and it's also the heart chakra mandala in Vajrayogini. Although Vajrayogini, like so many Tibetan deities, her chakra system is somewhat different than the Hindu. So let me go over the program that we had here so you get the idea of the scope of it. Now I'll give you the scope of this program that we got. And the Sakya Center at that time was called Thubten Dondrup Ling, and it was on South Berry Avenue in Los Angeles, and it was in a commercial area. It was like a big warehouse, but it had a penthouse on top of it, and this was like really, in a way, this is kind of like something out of a Fu Manchu novel. You'd drive down this dark alley and you'd park in this dark parking lot, and you'd go up this set of side stairs up to the roof, and then you go across the roof, and there are these great big steel doors, and you'd knock on the door, and the door would crack open, and a llama would peer out at you, and then they'd let you in. And inside, it's a Buddhist temple. I mean, this really was. It's like something out of a Sherlock Holmes movie. So that was the setting for this. Now, let me go over the program here and give you the idea of the scope of what they did with us. It's okay. Thursday, October 17th, Padmasambhava initiation. Now, Padmasambhava was the great Indian saint who first brought Tantric Buddhism to Tibet in the 7th century AD. The guru yoga of Padmasambhava dispels obstacles to Dharma practice. See, they're getting you started to give you a build-up on this. So there's not too much instruction on Padmasambhava. According to the story now, when the Muslims invaded India, they decided that they would let the Hindus live, and they decided to exterminate the Buddhists. And the reason why they said they did that is because they thought the Buddhists didn't believe in God, which is kind of, in a way, true, because they said that God was an illusion. So that gave the Muslims an excuse to go on a jihad against the Buddhists. And so the Buddhists fled. They had to flee because they were on the extermination genocide list. And so they had to flee, and they went up to Tibet. Well, Tibet at that time, around the 7th century, 8th century, A.D. This is around, a few hundred years after Muhammad, and the Muslims were, breaking out and going all and conquering all the areas, including India, Persia, and all that. And Tibet at that time was, their religion was called Bunpo, and it was shamanic. It was really a kind of a formalized version of Central Asian shamanism. And it has since become, by the way, Bunpo has since become much, much more like Tantric Buddhism. But then again, on the other hand, Tibetan Tantric Buddhism has some aspects of Bunpo, so they've kind of cross-pollinated themselves. But anyway, Padmasambhava stuff, all of the tantras and the sutras and all of the documents of Tantric Buddhism that he could possibly stuff into his saddlebag, jumped on his horse, and started riding north until he ran out of the Mujahideen, and he finally got up into the hills, and they tell a story on him, of course, that he got up into the hills and he was camped out in his little tent and he got attacked by demons, so he went out and pulled his tent peg out of the ground and warded the demons off with the tent peg. And that supposedly became the purba. That was the origin of that three, it's kind of a three bladed it's a spike with three ridges, iron spike with various decorations on it. It's a magical dagger. And that's how the purba came about, supposedly. And there are other people who say that it's actually a Central Asian arrowhead, but that's the other idea of it. Following the Padmasambhava initiation, we had a Mahavadokana initiation. And this was condensed initiation that purified negative actions and makes accessible an associated major practice of the Sakya tradition received in an unbroken lineage from Marpa Losawa and Sachin Konga Ningpo. And then following that, a White Tara initiation, and that was on Saturday, October 19th. And White Tara is a female deity who manifests herself in many aspects to render compassionate assistance to all beings. Now, it'd be an oversimplification, really, to say that Tara is a Tibetan counterpart to Kuan Yin. General sense, maybe that's true, because White Tara, now you have, by the way, we have White Tara, Red Tara, and Green Tara. Now, I also later on took a Red Tara initiation. And, of course, the colors indicate the general nature, of the White Tara is very peaceful, and Red Tara has more energy, obviously. But Tara is a cult into herself. Now, if you read about Vajrayogini currently, you find that she's the most popular female deity in the West, certainly. And she's supposed to be very, very popular in Tibet too, and she is, obviously. But Tara is really a cult into herself. And there is a good book on Tara, by the way, by Bayer, called the Cult of Tara, if you want to read it. And then the 19th we had a public talk, and then following on the 20th they have the White Tara teaching. And Luding Gan from Samtown explained the method for practicing a short form of the meditation, which bestowed the blessings of long life and protection from the inner and outer obstacles to the practice of the Dharma. Now, Dharma, by the way, is the whole process of Tibetan Buddhist teaching and practice. It's called the Dharma. Now, then, Wednesday, October 23rd through Friday, November 1st, we have the Vajrayogini Tri. Now, Vajrayogini is female, this is according to the program, is a female deity of enlightenment, the practice of her sadhana. Now, the sadhana, by the way, is the ritual. A tantra means ritual, but her sadhana is the one, is the practice, that's the practice, what the individual tantra practice is referred to. And her sadhana is of direct aid in gaining enlightenment itself. Receiving the tri depends on practicing the material that is presented each day prior to receiving the next day's teaching. And this was a very special course, and it's important that you are able to attend every day. Now, a prerequisite for the Vajrayogini tri was the receipt of the Hevajra initiation, or another equal empowerment. Now, I wanted to say that we had to get the Hevajra initiation before we could do Vajrayogini. Now, they didn't have an extended Hevajra teaching. Hevajra is a very high tantra. It's very complex, and we got that October 11th through October 13th. Two-day initiation is the most important Yidam practice of the Sakya tradition, and along with Vajrayogini. And it matures disciples through planting the seeds of the four kayas, empowers them to practice the Sri Hevajra sadhana, and is the key to many other teachings. Now, we did have one session on two sessions on the Hevajra teaching, but there is a good two volume book on Hevajra by Snellgrove called the Hevajra Tantra from Oxford Press, if you want to look that up. But Hevajra is a very complex system. However, what's good about Hevajra, aside from the fact that it is the plants the seed and it is the number one tantra of the Sakya order, is that you get a introduction to Tibetan psychic centers or the Tibetan chakra system, which, believe me, is different, really different than the Indian. This had a profound influence on me because, we've been working on extending Rigardi's middle pillar, which we've done, and the fact that that the Tibetans use a different systems, differ from Woodruff, from our classic Laya Yoga, which everybody thinks you have to do. No, the Tibetans, in fact, they have, you could say that they have somewhat different psychic center chakra arrangements for the different deities that they do. And this is something that a lot of the people in the West don't realize. They think that everything is, there's got to be like the serpent power. Well, it doesn't. Now, after the Hivajra initiation, then we got into Vajrayogini, and the Vajrayogini teachings, they started off, let's see, major teachings, and they started off with a soak offering and a revelation, dharmata, emptiness. Now, let me say this, revelation of emptiness. Now, you need to understand that even though you're doing bhakti yoga on Vajrayogini and you're bringing this goddess to life, and she can become like Tara, she can become a cult. And you can just, if you want to, most Tibetans probably wouldn't, but if you want to, you can just keep practicing Vajrayogini for the rest of your life. Most Tibetans go through a number. They like to get as many, do as many of these practices as they can and do them right. But you can make a cult out of Vajrayogini. Now, but let me say this about the Sakya tradition here, so you understand what emptiness is all about here. Sakya tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. Sakya tradition takes its name from the monastery founded in 1073 at Sakya, the place of the gray earth, in southwestern Tibet, by Konchong Gyalpo, a member of the Khon clan who studied the theories and methods of the new diffusion of Tantra's current in the 11th century. The Sakya tradition has two principal sub-schools, that of Nagore, founded in the 15th century, and the Tashar lineage, which dates to the 16th century. Now, we were working with the Nagore tradition, and Luding Ken was the abbot of the Nagore monastery. He's passed on now, by the way. This is very important. The special philosophical view of the Sakya school is called the non-differentiation of samsara and nirvana. It holds that mind itself, the union of luminosity and emptiness, is the root of both samsara and nirvana, and that the key to Buddhahood lies in this realization. In terms of spiritual training, the Sakya school has always stressed study and meditation in equal measure. Now, every major session that we did, we ended it with, after all of this visualization and all of this bringing the entities as much to life as we could and all that, we always ended it with a meditation, high as we could go, a meditation on emptiness to completely calm. I like the expression calm the mind. I know that Easterners want to empty the mind. I really don't want to empty, that was what they was emptying the mind and achieving emptiness. In the way of explaining this to some degree, it would be this. The Vajrayana practitioners will tell you Now, this is high vehicle Buddhism now. I said, no, there's two schools of Buddhism, the Southern School is Hinayana, and that's, well, Hinayana doesn't think it's a low vehicle, but the tantric, the Mahayana Buddhists will say that it is. And they feel now that Vajrayana is, or the bringing to life of all of these entities and going through these tantras, they feel that this is what they call the short way, as opposed to Zen Buddhism, which they consider to be the long way. In other words, what they're saying is we can get you to emptiness quicker than the Zen Buddhists can. We can get you to nirvana quicker. We can get you to the ecstasy of nothing, the ecstasy of well, I don't want to call it oblivion, but that's kind of a negative term. But let's just say blessed oblivion, blissful oblivion. We can get you there quicker than the Zen Buddhists can. And, you know, in a way, they may be right, because one of the big problems we have is, you know, from the beginning to the end of practice, a lot of times, is shutting up that little monkey. Oh, isn't it wonderful to just be able to just not have something chattering in your head and just be completely at peace with everything and just blessed emptiness. And the idea of doing all of this intense visualization to create these entities and then dissolve them. And this is, in a sense, seen like the ultimate power. The ultimate power. I can create life and I can dissolve it. And, you know, if you ask a Tibetan lama, you know, is there really a Shambhala? You know, I mean, and he says, oh, yes. And then you ask him, well, where is it? And he says, well, it's anywhere you want it to be. And then you say, or he may look at you, and if you say, is Shambhala real? And he may look at you and he say, is Los Angeles real? Yeah, you know? This reminds me of a, you know, oh, well. Anyway, this is the ultimate. So even though Vajrayana, now, at the present time, at least by people who like Vajrayogini, and there's a lot of Tibetans and a lot of Americans who do, and Westerners who do, she's considered a high-level tantra, but there are those who think she's, you know, she's a mid-level tantra. But they're the ones who aren't really into Vajrayogini, I guess. But she is considered to be a living representation of the Buddha. Now, one thing you want to understand, too, is many of these deities, including Vajrayogini, have a consort. They have a male consort, and they're quite often, like Kalachakra and various ones, they're quite often pictured standing up like you may. The typical one would be the god stands up, and his consort has got her legs wrapped around him, and they're in congrex. And it's pretty sexy, actually. But so you're actually visualizing both of them, and you're working both of them, their attributes. In the case of Vajrayogini, that's not true. She's the whole deal. I mean, she's it. Now, I know that our Gardnerian ladies, oh boy, did they ever! They were ardent feminists, and Vajrayogini was just, yeah. You know, they liked Vajrayogini so much they actually went over to Dharamsala to do more Vajrayogini, you know, she is very, very, very powerful and very delightful and I think very accessible. That's one of the things some of these tantras, like, you know, I'm sorry, but I just really can't get warmed up to hey, Vajra very much. But boy, Vajrayogini can really really become a friend. Now, something else, though, that I want to mention is that we were so fortunate in having Psalm 10, our American Llama. And this young man, I mean, really, he was an Ivy League college graduate student and got his PhD studying Eastern religions, and liked it, got so wrapped up with it that he decided to go over to Dharamsala and become a Lama. And he's got fluent in Tibetan, writes in Tibetan, fluent in Sanskrit. And by the way, you mentioned that something here that I want to mention, that Sanskrit, Indian Sanskrit, is the, because Buddhism, you know, got started down in India, Sanskrit is the sacred language that you find that Tibetans use, interspersed. Their mantras are all in Sanskrit, and their seed letters and their mantras and whatever. And this is like us using Hebrew in Hermetic Kabbalah. You know, we in our Hermetic practice we use Hebrew formulas. We also use Greek too. But now when you do Bunpo, when the Bunpos come to town, you'll find that all of their rituals are all in Tibetan. There is no Sanskrit, at least not from what I've seen in the Bunpo that I've been exposed to. It's all Tibetan. But so we had our mantras, and that's another thing. The mantras in Vajrayogini are much, much easier to handle than they are in others. Like the basic mantra, you know, is Om 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 Sarva Buddha Dikiniya Vajravananiya Vajravirachaniya Om 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 Pepe Pe Saha. That's it. I mean, you can do that. Do that 21 times a day. Now, and they even wrote a short sadhana just for us. Their idea of a short sadhana is you repeat affirmations, you repeat pranayama, you repeat mantras, everything 100 times. That's a short one for them. It takes, you know, half the morning to do it. But they knew that the Westerners, and I'm sure Psalm 10, you know, has something to do with this, I said, no, these people, they just, you know, these Westerners, they can't handle that. Get up to go try to do all this before they go to work in the morning. You know, come on now. Or after they come home and before they have their martini or whatever, they can't do all this. So they cut it down for us. They cut it down to 21 reps of everything. And, oh, boy, that made it, which, you know, it'll work. Yeah, you know, like I'll tell you, it won't work as well, but, I mean, it will work. So I thought that was the bare minimum for when we, you know, started doing our extension of Bugatti's metal pillar that we worked on. And we took using the Vajrayogini program tailored for Westerners as our model for that. And now, there are a lot of very, you know, interesting practices. So I feel like, I don't want to be revealing stuff that is still secret. If you go to Sakya Trezin's website, and you'll go there and you'll look, and they don't have the documents up yet for Vajrayogini, and they've got Luding Kin's collection listed, but they don't have anything in it yet. And I think probably our syllabus, which is 100 pages long, the one that's called Vajrayogini Teaching According to the Ultimate Secret Yoga, in the Naro Kacho tradition, written by Jamyang Chenzi Wangchuk, and of course translated by Naro Wang Sam Tim. I would hope that maybe they would get at least a short version of this up on the Sakya Trezin website sometime. They say they've got a slot, you know, for this, so maybe they'll have. But But they are, apparently, they are, still going around doing these programs. So you might very well be able to get one. Now, give you the idea of the syllabus here. Chapter 1, Yoga of Sleep. Chapter 2, the Yoga of Arising. The Yoga of Nectar Tasting. The Yoga of Four Limitless Meditations. The Yoga of the Guru. The Yoga of Creating Oneself in the Form of the Deity. Uh-huh. Yeah. The Yoga of Purification of the Living Beings. The Yoga of Receiving the Blessings of the Heroes and the Heroines. The Yoga of Recitation. The Yoga of Meditation Beyond Thought. The Yoga of Experiential Practices. And then the process of creation, identifying the body through concentration, process of contemplation. And then it says, note, this Vajrayogini teaching according to the ultimate secret yoga of the Naryopa tradition was written by the sub-disciple of Sarachin, Losao Gyatso, Jamyang Kensei Wangchuck. And it is translated into English by His Holiness Sakyakusin and Nawang Samten Chopel. At the auspicious Sakya Dolma Padrang during 1976-1977. Now, hopefully, as I say, this is going to be made more available. It looks like maybe it is. And I want to mention that there are some other things in Vajrayogini that you're going to find really, really fascinating. One is it has its own paradise. Now, Vajrayogini goes beyond the paradise, but Vajrayogini, they have a paradise. They have a little paradise you can visit. This, I say, a little paradise. It's the land. It's the city of the Dakinis, and it's kind of like, in a way, it's sort of like what. The head of the assassins, you remember, used to offer his devotees. They'd get them whacked on a mixture of hashish and opium. And we don't. I'm not saying we ever did anything like that. No, but then they would go to paradise, and they'd have all these beautiful virgins, you know, that they'd have in paradise, and then they would wake up. And the master would tell them, well, now, if you want to achieve this paradise, go out and do something, whatever. Well, you've got this kind of a paradise in Vajrayogini, but it's a paradise that you need to work through. One of the things that Vajrayogini Vajrayogini is a wonderful tantra for young people with a lot of desire. You call it lust too, if you want. But if you got a lot of desire, you want to translate that sexual energy into something really positive and something really creative. This is the way to do it, because Vajrayogini is very, very sexy, and so heard that the little paradise that you go to is very sexy. And the idea is that, there's got to be something beyond this. And, of course, there is, because Vajrayogini goes on to merge with the Buddha head. Or she is, a form of Buddha, and she merges with the infinite. And you merge with her. And we also did the Tummo. Let me tell something about Tummo. They have a secret method that's really cute, and I don't know whether I want to mention it, but this secret method for lighting your Tummo fire down in your tummy, and I think I'll pass. If you get the Vajrayogini program, you'll like it. But anyway, Tummo, you read in Evans Ransom, David Neal, all these Tummo experts. They can stand out naked in freezing weather and dry all these wet towels on themselves and all this kind of business. They generate all this heat. Well, yeah, maybe they can, but that's not the purpose of Tummo. The purpose of Tummo is energy, is spiritual energy and energy for the practice of the Dharma. And this, if you understand this, this business of drying wet towels becomes sort of a very low version of it. Tumo, by the way, their Tumo Center is right behind the Naval. And this is exactly where we place HAWD and we place our chemical center for the same purpose in our middle pillar exercise. Now, the practice of POWA. POWA is transference of consciousness, actually, is what it amounts to. But it is also considered to be practice for death. And every complete tantra, if you got a complete tantric system, will have a POWA ritual in it that you will do. And one, they have what we call in Vajrayogini a common, the regular system, and then there's what they call the uncommon teaching. Now, the uncommon teaching is really something a little more advanced. But in the uncommon teaching, it's you start dissolving your body from the bottom up until finally there's nothing left but your consciousness. And that proceeds on. This is a very effective, very effective method. The chode ritual, I think we did a, we did a chitty potty. I remember we did something similar to chode. It probably was this chitty potty initiation. Chitty potty, by the way, is the god of the cemetery. And actually, Chitty Potty is two gods, it's two dancing skeletons. And that's they are particular protectors of the Vajrayogini tradition. And I think that's where we ended up doing a chode. Now, what a chode ritual is when originally the chode was supposed to be where you take a superstitious young lama aspirant, take him out in the cemetery, tie him to a tombstone and at sundown, and tell him to invoke all the demons he can possibly imagine and let them and if he survives in the morning, if he's still alive and he knows that, then he knows that it's all illusions. Well, that's the story. But anyway, the chode ritual is you cut yourself up and feed yourself. You got a skull cup cooking in front of you, and you cut yourself up, feed yourself to the hungry ghosts. And we did that. But a lot of these things are all symbolic. And something I want to mention, too, is that this is all preceded by a technique called going for refuge. And you go for refuge, this is compassion. This is a refuge from which you are safe, and you can then aid all the sentient beings of the entire universe that you can. It's a sort of a place from which you can extend love to all people. This is a Buddhist the part of the tantra that is primarily Buddhist. And like the beginning and the end of these sessions, you go for refuge at the beginning, and in the end, you go for blissful oblivion. And so you got the Buddhism at the first at the beginning, and the Buddhism at the end, and in the middle, we can have a lot of fun with essentially pagan entities, which we can get all the power and the inspiration out of them. So this gives you kind of an idea of what this program's like. I think I want to mention too that our first priestess in the OTA was a back in 1970, was a woman who has gone on to become a full professor of political science at one of the at a prestigious Eastern university. She's a very, very a regular female Indiana Jones, by the way. This lady, she went on and did a Marjorie Argini program back east. She found one. So Marjorie Argini and the OTA have a close relationship. I got about 4 minutes left, and I would recommend, as I said, go to the Sakya website. That's H-H-H-period, that stands for His Holiness, because Sakya Drazen is His Holiness, but he's a real nice person too. And I, by the way, I got several more initiations from him later on. I got a Black Manjushri from Sakya Drazen. I got a Bajri Kalaya, that's a Purva initiation from Sakya Drazen. And I think Sakya Drazen is really, really he's a close personal friend of the Dalai Lama. So go to his website and check out and see if you can find a Vajra Yogini. Okay, next week, Process Church of the Final Judgment. We're going to review the new book written by Timothy Wiley and Adam Humphrey on the Church of the Final Judgment, the process, the most notorious and most sensational and notorious cult of the 1970s. This the process, Church of the Final Judgment. And the book is Love, Sex, and Fear Death. And so yes, something to look forward to next week. This will really be an interesting show. And that concludes our broadcast for tonight, and good magic.